Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Welcome back to Future Proof with me, Luke O'Neill. So we all need sleep, but what actually makes us tired? Now, new research points to mitochondria, very close to my own heart, actually, the cell's energy factories, as the surprising trigger. Now, joining us on Future Proof is Professor Gero Miezenbuch, who's Director of the Centre for Neural Circuits and Behaviour at the University of Oxford, to tell us all about it. You're very welcome to the programme, Gero.
Thank you so much, Luke. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, tell our listeners what you've discovered, because it's absolutely fascinating, a connection from mitochondria to sleep.
Well, we've been working on sleep, this extremely mysterious behavior, for the past 15 years or so. Sleep is mysterious because it's seemingly counterproductive, right? You are vulnerable, you are unproductive, you have risks and costs that must somehow be offset by a benefit, but we don't really know what that benefit is. So our approach was to look for molecular changes in a class of neurons that are important for putting animals to sleep. And what we found is that all the clues pointed to mitochondria.
And was that a surprise? Yeah, because it must have been a surprise to you, was it initially? Anyway?
It was initially surprising, but I should say that we had hints from a previous study where we looked at the specific ion channels that regulate the electrical activity of these sleep-inducing neurons. And one of these channels had a redox-sensitive subunit.
Right.
And that was sort of a little bit of a smoking gun that redox chemistry might play a role. And as you know, the principal site of biological redox chemistry is mitochondria.
Right. Yes, you're relentlessly drawn to them again eventually, that it has to be mitochondria. And the gene expression changes, isn't that right? Just, you picked up on expression of genes that code for components in the mitochondria.
Exactly.
That was a clue,
yes,
as well, wasn't it? And what strikes me is, just to get into a bit more detail, I mean, I read the paper. It's a fantastically well-written paper. So it's great to read in Nature, of course.
Thank you.
And you make the point that sleep emerges with oxygen, doesn't it, on Earth?
That's what we think. So oxygen has a very, very interesting history on our planet. Actually, life initially evolved in a completely anoxic atmosphere. All the oxygen that's around us is actually the product of life on Earth. And as oxygen began to accumulate as a result of life, life had to adapt to the changes in the environment that it itself caused. And one of these major adaptations was the formation of mitochondria about 2.4, 2.5 billion years ago, when one bacterium engulfed another, and the two then formed a symbiosis that has never ceased to exist. So this was the first eukaryotic cell. What the acquisition of mitochondria gave the host bacterium was the ability to convert foodstuff about 15-fold more efficiently into energy than what was possible before. So an enormous amount of energy gain. But the energy gain came with a risk, and that risk has to do with this very peculiar chemical structure of oxygen. Oxygen is a very, very strange gas, and it basically, if you have an electron-conducting wire, like the mitochondria in fact are, in the presence of oxygen, that wire becomes leaky. And so that was the big problem that that life had to deal with. Now, about 570 to 750 million years ago, there was another big increase in atmospheric oxygen levels. And during that increase, it is thought, the complexity of multicellular life expanded enormously. This is the famous Cambrian explosion of multicellular life. And it was during that time that we have the first hints of nervous systems, and virtually coincident with them, the first hints that sleep also appeared.
Right. Yeah, they're coincident with each other, aren't they? And is it the case here, just to get the mechanistic aspect here, I suppose, like the mitochondria are doing their job, but over the course of a day, say, whatever the time frame is, damage begins to build up in the mitochondria in a way. And that damage would be reactive oxygen, as you say.
It's That's what we think. So it's... Yeah, so we think what happens is that the mitochondria always leak a little bit of electrons. That's in the very nature of the beast. And the damage that builds up is mostly among membrane lipids that are extremely susceptible to reactive oxygen species. They get peroxidized. This was a study that we published in Nature a few months ago. And the mechanism, that redox-sensitive ion channel that I referred to before, that we now know is actually a sensor for peroxidation breakdown products. So it senses, it effectively counts the appearance of breakdown products of peroxidized lipids. And once that count exceeds a certain threshold, the sleep-inducing neurons switch on and they put the animal to sleep.
Right. That's the remarkable part, isn't it? And then is the sleep then restorative? Is that the idea? In other words, you have to fall asleep in order to allow the mitochondria to go back to normal, or at least begin to behave in a way that's less damaging. Is that the idea here?
That would be the idea. That would be the implication. But I should say you've put your finger on the big open question in all of this. Because I think we've built up a pretty good understanding over the past 15 years of what happens while the fly is awake. So we know that the mitochondria leak electrons, that the electrons combine with oxygen, form reactive oxygen species, that lipids get damaged, and that ultimately the sleep-inducing neurons switch on, the animal goes to sleep. But we still don't have any direct clue of what actually happens during sleep, how it is that sleep actually resets or simply prevents the accumulation of more damage. We don't know.
That's the next phase of it, I think. Can I ask you a very technical question from my own research? Is the reverse electron transport happening? Because in our lab, we've shown you get reverse electron transport up the chain in mitochondria. Is that happening here, do you think? Or is it just regular leak, should we say?
So we think it's a regular leak in most of the brain. But these sleep-inducing neurons, obviously, when the animal is awake, the sleep-inducing neurons have to be inhibited. And that means that their ATP demands are very low. So they are prone to an oversupply of electrons, so a very high NADH to NAD plus ratio, a fully charged mitochondrial membrane potential, ATP reserves that are full. And as you know, these are the conditions that would lead to reverse electron transport.
Yeah. That's a great, you and me having a highly technical discussion on Irish radio about reverse electron transport. Isn't it wonderful? The other thing I want to ask you is, and this is in your paper, this is a general question, I guess, as well, small animals versus big animals, right? So small animals, like a mouse, say, they have a shorter lifespan, but they spend a lot more time asleep, whereas bigger animals have a longer lifespan and spend less time asleep. You're discovering ties into that, doesn't it? I mean, even though your model is the fruit fly, you can extend it into other animals, can't you?
That's what we think, yes. So it has been known for about half a century, thanks to work by one of the giants of early sleep research, Alan Rechtschaffen of the University of Chicago, that there is a relationship between body size, mass-specific oxygen consumption, and a range of physiological parameters that that includes sleep. So the rule is the smaller you are, the more oxygen each gram of tissue in your body burns per unit time. And that has a number of consequences. So the smaller you are, the more oxygen consumption, the faster your heartbeat, the shorter your life, and somewhat tragically, the greater a fraction of your short life you actually spend asleep.
It's very strange, isn't it, that you've had a short life and you sleep a lot? That's the peculiar part. But that's that's all consistent with what you've discovered here, isn't it? That scenario.
It would seem to be, yes.
Right, which is reassuring, I guess. And the other thing I want to ask you about is things like sleep deprivation, for example, or people. If we can go to humans, I know it's a bit dangerous here because obviously you have a model organism here. But what will this mean for humans, do you think? And if someone is sleep deprived, or you know, whatever it might be, and the harm that might do to them. I wonder, are there any consequences of what you found for human?
I mean, I can only speculate about the implications to humans, but we know in general that sleep deprivation is not a good thing. And I think there's also implications for diet and nutrition. So there's this fundamental connection between energy metabolism, mitochondria, sleep, and the range of degenerative processes that run the gamut from just normal aging to all kinds of degenerative diseases. So it's widely known, and you can do the experiment on yourself, that if you restrict your caloric intake, so you fast, your sleep need will typically drop. At least that's something that I experienced. There's a lot of epidemiological evidence in humans, in rodents, in fruit flies, that there's a relationship that holds. So it seems to me that whenever you have a surplus of fuel, a surplus of energy, an overabundance of energy, you do pay a price. So this is something I would watch out for, either by making sure you don't stuff yourself with junk food, or if you enjoy a hearty meal, that you actually also do the exercise to burn the calories that you eat.
That's what makes it really fascinating, doesn't it, in a sense? I mean, if it's obesity, for example, being a risk factor for all these diseases, is that because the mitochondria, as we know, are being disturbed? And now your discovery brings the mitochondrial disturbance into sleep as well. And if anything, we've known this since for thousands of years, a good night's sleep is a wonderful thing, isn't it? But what your discovery is telling us is mechanistically why, you know, that might be so important.
Yep, we think so. So as the wonderful graduate student who is the first author on the paper said, sleep is not a cognitive luxury, it's a metabolic necessity.
Ah, very good.
Very good, yeah.
Super. And Jerry, what's next? What are you working on at the moment to do further work on this?
So the next question, I think we've already touched upon, or you have touched on it, and that is what actually happens during sleep. So that's a key open question. Then, of course, there's the problem that every Drosophila researcher faces. If you want to be taken seriously, you've got to do something in a mammal. So one of the next items on the agenda is to ask whether the same mechanism also holds true in the brains of more complex organisms. And I can say that there's some preliminary evidence that suggests strongly that it does.
Right.
I think a third area that interests me in particular is the interplay of the two genomes in mitochondria.
Yeah.
So mitochondria have, in humans, it's 13 proteins that are still encoded by a short circular mitochondrial genome. And whereas all the other proteins have migrated to the nucleus.
Right.
And the question is always, why have these 13 proteins had to stay out there on this thing? And what is the functional consequences?
Right. And yeah, that's another mystery that you might well crack. Well, Jerry, thanks ever so much for joining us. It's a fantastic study and well done. Jerry Miesenbuch, Director of the Centre for Neural Circuits and Behaviour at the University of Oxford.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae,
proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.